Stacey Alosio. I'm the emergency manager for the city of Northport, and I'm going to discuss first responders after the storm. So it may take a while for first responders to get to after the storm, and that's due to a variety of reasons. One being, we pull first responders off the roads when tropical storm force winds are sustained for their safety. That is a standard usually across the state and other states that have hurricanes as well. So we will have a backlog of calls that have come in during the storm that we will prioritize based on urgency, and they'll be responding to those, as well as the calls that are currently coming in if they're urgent as well. Also, the roads might be flooded, there might be debris in the roads. Our tactical first in teams will be going out right away to clear the roads of any hazards so that our vehicles can get through and respond as quickly as possible. Just keep that in mind when you call after a disaster for assistance. We are coming. You are very important to us. We care about our residents and their safety, but it may just take a while for us to get to you depending on the conditions of the roads.
My name is Mario Venditti. I am the planner scheduler for the City of Northport Solid Waste. I got into this position, first I was a recycle driver for 5 years.
Today's Monday, May 5th, Cinco de Mayo, 2025. It's 10 a.m. We're in the city chambers, and I call the city commission workshop meeting to order. Commissioners present are Commissioner Duval, Mr. Langdon, Mayor Stokes, Vice Mayor Emmerich, and Commissioner Petrov is absent. There is a quorum present for this meeting. Also present, City Manager Fletcher, Interim City Attorney Golan, City Clerk Faust, Board Specialist Lane, Police Chief Garrison, and Fire Chief Titus. Let us see. Jason, would you do us the honor, buddy?
To the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, liberty
and justice. City Clerk, any public comments?
I got three topics. The first one is recycling over at the Family Service Center. I've been hanging out there in the office of Meals on Wheels for several months, and there is no recycling within the building. I carry my own paper and recycling items out of the building to discard them properly. So even in this building, we have recycled bins. And so I would highly suggest we have that at the Family Center. Also, somewhere along the line has been changed. Us past or former commissioners were always invited to ribbon cuttings and groundbreakings. We put in years of work within projects, and then we are no longer invited to do the hoorah. I find that disappointing, and I would like to see that old system of doing things brought back. The last one is your meeting today talks on the linear parking. That has been a thorn in my side since 2017 when I got on board. It was supposed to be paid for through surtax, and I would still recommend it be paid with surtax. Not the businesses along those strips paying for it, not meters going up in a section where we're having people come in from the outside to do business with our city. It needs to be done through surtax. The money was in there. It was stolen years ago by commissioners making decisions to pay for something else. A pot of $25,000 was left in for both sides. That eventually got taken too. So don't know if it's on your current list of surtax, but it needs to be. It's unfair to put that burden on these citizens, and especially the businesses, when it should have and was part of surtax all along. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Moving on to presentations. 25-2185, presentation regarding 2025 hurricane season and city preparedness effort. City manager, your item.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. We're going to have a presentation by our emergency manager, Stacey Licio, and deputy city manager, Mike Navarez. Thank you both.
Thank you. Can we get the presentation up on the, it's on this computer.
Yeah, there we go.
I think I'm too tall.
We're good. All right, I'm Stacey Licio. I'm the emergency manager for the city of Northport.
Good morning, I'm Mike Navarez. I'm the deputy emergency manager.
Yes, so today we're gonna talk about the 2024 hurricane season, some of the lessons learned there, some of the challenges that we face that we are working to improve the city so that we can tackle those, continue to tackle those in the future. And then we'll also talk about what the 2025 hurricane outlook is going to look like and how we're preparing the city. So, seems like it was just yesterday. It was hurricane season 2024, and now we're quickly heading into 2025 season. Last year, Sarasota County was impacted by three storms, Debbie, Helene, and Milton. They were three very different storms with very different impacts. Debbie was a rainmaker. It dumped 17 inches of rain in Sarasota County and caused a lot of inland flooding there. We also had Helene, and that's what this picture is Hurricane Helene. You can see how far the eye of the storm is from Sarasota County's coast, and it's still pushed 7 to 9 feet of storm surge on those barrier islands and pushed water up the Myakka and past some of our water control structures here in Northport. So it just shows that the center of the storm can still be hundreds of miles away, and we can still see significant storm surge impacts from those storms that parallel the coast. And then Hurricane Milton, that was a direct perpendicular impact, pretty much 90 degrees right at Siesta Key. That caused significant storm surge, but not as widespread. It didn't impact a bigger area because it was that direct impact, but we had a lot of wind and debris also from that because we had the eye wall come right through Sarasota County. So we had stronger winds there. So different impacts for different storms, no storm is alike, and that was definitely something that was reinforced last season. It also reinforced the need for a hardened EOC for the city. People who are here and work in this building during a storm know that it's not a comfortable place to sleep. There's no showers. It's very loud when the storm is passing over. It doesn't have a lot of the technology needs, and having to be activated twice, staying overnight on two separate occasions, living here, it reinforced the need to have a facility here in the city, a standalone hardened EOC. And then the realistic threat from back-to-back storms. You know, it's a hypothetical, what happens if there's a back-to-back? Odds are that won't happen. Well, it happened. We had three storms, really, that impacted Sarasota County. Very, very, very close to here. If Hurricane Helene was just a little bit closer to our coast, Hurricane Milton was just a little bit further south, we would have had substantial damage here back-to-back within 10 days. So it's definitely something that is on our radar, and we're going to continue to be prepared for. Resource and preparedness measures, debris, messaging, those are all things that we worked through and we're continuing to improve. A big challenge with debris, not so much for us because we weren't as heavily impacted as Sarasota County, was the competition for debris vendors, because Helene not only impacted Florida, but all the way up into North Carolina. And then Hurricane Milton came through, and there's only so many debris haulers and monitors around, so it was really a struggle to get debris haulers into Sarasota County, and that's something that we're working with the county. If that were to happen again, how can we mitigate that and make sure we have the resources here that we need? And then that goes into that funding piece, which I won't get too much into the referendum, but the emergency borrowing and being able to fund the back-to-back disasters. We're constantly talking about what we can do to leverage existing funding. So things that we've improved. Our emergency personnel policy, we updated the process for implementing the policy. So we have now our emergency role policy that we'll talk about a little bit further in the presentation as well. But we created updates along with human resources and the city manager's office to leverage everybody in the city to be able to help us prepare for, respond to, and recover from disasters. We have a vast variety of skills in the city. We want to make sure that we put all those skills to use to the best of our abilities after disaster to respond and recover more quickly. We updated our plans based on lessons learned. That includes our comprehensive emergency management plan, our evacuation plans. And then we also had workshops all last week to create plans for each section working in the Emergency Operations Center. Mutual aid agreements and contracts. We're working on a mutual aid agreement with Florida Power and Light to have them stage here in the city, which would be great. Right now they stage at the Brave Stadium for basically regional response, but to have a response dedicated just for Northport here will be a great resource for us to have. We're constantly doing hurricane trainings and exercises, not only with our city personnel, but also with our partners. We have increased collaboration with local, state, federal, and non-governmental partners. We're constantly working with county, the state, FEMA. We have a Coast Guard auxiliary here in Sarasota County. There's all sorts of partners here. And our non-governmental partners, that's United Way, does amazing work for the city of Northport. They have a long-term recovery group that is now handling recovery from not only Ian, but Debbie, Helene, and Milton as well, and they're going to continue to do that great work here. Established additional department operations center, so Parks and Rec, they are going to have a department operations center now. We're having discussions with other departments as well, just so that we can better collaborate with the departments after a disaster. They have their core people on site or somewhere with connectivity so that we never lose contact with them and all of our departments can continue to operate. And then our storm ready renewal, which Deputy Emergency Manager Mike Naveras did a lot of great work working with the National Weather Service to get our storm ready status renewed. So we are a storm ready city still. Okay, and I'll hand it over to Mike to talk about the predictions for next season.
So that takes us to what the 2025 season might look like. The headline that they've been saying is a dynamic hurricane season, which I think is another way of just saying a potentially above average hurricane season again. So what average looks like is 14 named storms, so that anything that's a tropical storm or greater, they name. 7 hurricanes and 3 majors, which is a Category 3 hurricane or above. That's an average season. Last year, we had an above average season. We had 18 named storms, 11 of them formed into hurricanes, and 5 of them were that Category 3 or higher major storm. So looking at the different predictions, we look at 3 of them because the National Hurricane Center, which is the official prediction, is not out yet. So AccuWeather, they give a range for theirs. So they're predicting anywhere between 13 to 18 named storms. So pretty much above that average point, 7 to 10 hurricanes and 3 to 5 majors. Colorado State University, although Colorado has never once been hit by a hurricane, their meteorology department has a premier hurricane forecast that we look at very closely every year. They're saying 17 on the named storms, so pretty close to that 2024 season, 9 hurricanes and 4 majors. And then right here at home, we have the Sarasota Climate Adaptation Center, which is a 501c3 nonprofit that does a lot of meteorological work. They're saying 17 named storms as well, 10 hurricanes, and 5 majors. And then the National Hurricane Center, we expect to get that information on May 15th. They put their official forecast out 2 weeks beforehand. Which takes us to why. Why another potentially above average season? So, very high level on the intense meteorological stuff. There's a couple different factors that all these different centers look at for their forecast. First one is how hot the water is. So they're still predicting above average surface temperatures, but the sea surface temperatures this year do not seem like they're going to be near as high as last year, which is a good sign for us in comparison to last year's season. But a lot of that can change just depending upon how much rain we get and how hot the summer is. So this is definitely our initial projection and could change. Then there's the neutral ENSO, that's the El Nino, La Nina. So we're going to be in a neutral, we're not going to be in either El Nino or La Nina this year, or hurricane season. And basically El Nino makes it generally that the Atlantic hurricane season is less, and La Nina makes it more, just depending upon where the wind currents are and how much shear there is. So being in net neutral, being in between the two, it means that that's really not going to have too much of an effect. So it's going to be kind of, that's going to be more of the average side of it. Then there is the Bermuda High. So basically around Bermuda, there is this high pressure system that is always there, but it ebbs and flows of about how high that is. And when it gets stronger, it basically pushes things away from it. So this year they're predicting a stronger Bermuda High, which means that those potential tropical waves and tropical storms, they're going to form lower down, which usually puts us a bit more of a path towards Florida. Then if it's weaker, that's where it curves off into the Atlantic a little bit more. Then there is, overall, they're predicting a lower level of wind shear. So wind shear is really what took down Milton. So wind shear is when you have those higher level winds that are stronger, it makes it harder for those hurricanes to form or stay formed. So if you have lower levels of wind shear, then that's a little bit more conducive to hurricanes forming. And then the last one is that Saharan dust. So as you get dust pulled off of the Saharan Desert, and goes into the air there, it makes it harder because hurricanes really need moisture to form. So as more dust is blown off of Africa, it really stifles the ability of those hurricanes to form. So they're predicting a little bit less Saharan dust this year than last year. And that's usually seen in the earlier part of hurricane season. Generally, the dust kind of ramps down by the time you get to September, which is another reason why like late August to early October is your that peak hurricane time frame. Early October, yeah.
All right, so like I stated earlier, we're continuing to prepare. We would be preparing whether the hurricane forecast was zero storms, whether it said, you know, 20 storms. It only takes one to hit Northport for it to be a bad season for us, so we're always prepared and ready to go whenever we're needed. So we're continuing to implement lessons learned from Helene and Milton. We have a corrective action spreadsheet, where we're making sure that all the lessons that we've learned are being implemented, and we've been keeping track of all of that, improving coordination among departments and external partners with our trainings and exercises and our regular communication. Web EOC, so that is a software that is not new to the state of Florida, but it's going to be new to Northport. The state of Florida has been using it for several years, and it's how they process all of our resource requests. So now we have our own Web EOC instance that will allow us to be on the same system as the county and the state. So when we request resources, it'll be a lot more streamlined. We'll be able to have more visibility of where our resources are after we order them. So that is a big step up for us, and we're very excited to have that rolling this hurricane season. Expanding the emergency roles for city employees. So we now have a tier system. So there are four tiers that a city employee can be assigned to. Tier one is our first responders. That includes fire, PD, public works, utilities, some of our development services that do those damage assessments. We consider those first responders. They're out in the field right after the disaster. Then we have tier two. Those are the people that work in this building. That is emergency operations center workers, the call center, and then the communications personnel who work in the joint information center. We have tier three. Those are the department essential people. So those are the people who are assigned mission essential functions that need to happen to keep the continuity of government happening for their department. And then we have tier four. They're not assigned anything, but they're on standby and they're ready to go. So with every disaster, you never know what's going to come up. So it could be that we need to open a second staging area. So we need to call in more employees. So they're at home on standby, ready to go. We call them and we bring them in to help. And they'll get last minute training and ensure that all safety is in place for those staff. But so everybody is assigned to a specific tier, and that's very helpful because for me during a disaster, if I do have to have an operation pop up that I need staff, I now have a list of people who are ready and available to come in and assist. So it is going to be a way to have our personnel a lot more organized this year. Very excited about that. And then we're identifying mitigation strategies for critical infrastructure. There's some mitigation grants that Sarasota County has available to us. Mike Navarez has done a great job working with the local mitigation group, actually helped create their point system for ranking all the projects. Just give them a little plug. So we have identified some projects for that, and we're hoping to get some funding through the Helene and Milton mitigation grants.
All right. And then really, hurricane preparedness starts at the individual level. So it's definitely something that you all can help us with to get this word out to as many people as possible. The first thing that we want everybody to know is to understand their evacuation level. So evacuation level is different than a flood zone. It's based upon storm surge, and it's the way in which the county and the city will call evacuations in preparation of hurricanes, really for life-saving measures. And different than a flood zone, which is that day-to-day, how risky is my personal property to flooding in a non-hurricane event? And we also want everybody to sign up for Alert Sarasota, going to alertsarasotacounty.com, and that's how individuals can sign up for those emergency alerts. So if something impacts the city of Northport or Sarasota, that's where those buzzers are going to go off on their phone to give them that life-saving information. There are also 4 evacuation centers within Northport. Generally, the county's policy has been to open every single evacuation center every time evacuation centers are open. So those locations are Northport High School, Aaron Creek Middle, Atwater Elementary, and Woodland Middle. And that information is all on our website as well as the county's website. And all of those evacuation centers are pet friendly. But as we kind of like to say, the evacuation centers are lifeboats. They're not cruise ships. Basically, it's a space on the floor that is in a safe building and nothing else. So if somebody's going to an evacuation center, we want them to bring everything that they need for that time there, including anything that they have for their pets, any medication, all of that. The county also offers a medical needs program registration. So this is typically for individuals that have special medical needs. Somebody, typically it'll be electrical dependency. Somebody might need electricity for oxygen. They might have a refrigerated medication that they need. So to do so, they can go on to the county's website to sign up for that medical needs program. And the county will go through and approve them. And there are special medical needs evacuation centers that are only for those people that are on those lists. And it ensures definitely redundancy for that electricity so that those individuals that have those special needs and access functional needs are able to have that life-saving care. And it has generally a greater degree of intervention as well from providers. We also heavily encourage everybody to have a disaster supply kit. The guidance used to be 3 days. It's now going up to 7 days nationwide. And really, it gives people that comfort, that safety to have the supplies that they need for those 7 days, you know, because we don't know what individual disasters are going to look like. We don't know the state of the city. We are going to be coming out to help everybody as soon as possible. But we know that in a widespread incident like Ian, where there's total loss throughout parts of the city, that we want to have people to be as self-reliant for those 7 days as possible. So there is a really great supply kit on the ready.gov page that we link to on our website as well. So people can go on there and see a sample supply kit for building out everything that they might need for those 7 days. And then we encourage people to prepare their homes ahead of a hurricane. So that's putting up your shutters. That's taking things outside that might be debris and bringing them indoors and just getting the house ready, whether you're planning to evacuate or planning to shelter in place. And then we have some great events to get this information out to residents as well. We have our annual Hurricane Expo that's going to be on May 31st at GMAC from 10 to 2. And then we also, Stacy and I will go out and we'll talk to residents, we'll talk to communities, talk to HOAs, we can speak at churches, wherever that we can get this information out to people. People can sign up to have Stacy and I come out there and share this life-saving information by going to northportfl.gov, request a speaker, and we'll come out and we'll say this to anybody. So we want to get this information.
Any questions?
Commissioners?
I have a couple. One, a comment. I went to the recent employee training for their emergency roles, and that was very well done. I really commend you for sort of making that response more robust. I think that's terrific. I was looking for a role, though, and I didn't see myself on the list. So, and then a question. Stay out of the way. The Web EOC, that software package, would it be appropriate, or do we integrate our local nonprofits and business community as part of that? I recall, particularly after Ian, that our nonprofits, not just those located in Northport, but some that are located further away, really helped with supply disbursements and all of that kind of thing. Would it be appropriate to link them in, or is it really, I mean, if we're requesting support, it might be a great way of integrating those folks into the response, just a suggestion.
We might not be able to have them log in directly, but absolutely we want to capture that information any way that we can. WebEOC allows us to set up mapping, so we want to coordinate through the nonprofit network to get as many of those sites coordinated, and we can map all of that out through WebEOC and push that information out so that we have the nonprofit channel that's all working together, and we know about all those sites that are up and coming, because I know that during a disaster, there's a lot of nonprofits and a lot of faith-based organizations out there doing the good work, and if we can get a handle on that, we want to.
Right, because I think it's helpful if we have three street corners that need coverage to not have three nonprofits on one street corner and two empties. So, again, just a thought.
Thank you.
I remember after Ian that one of the issues was that Northport did not have a representative in the county EOC. Are we addressing that in our enhanced policy so that before the storm hits, we have representation there?
ACM Belia does a fabulous job up there for us. We call her with a question, and she goes right up to the table that representative is at and gets us everything we need.
Yes, rock I heard star. She was a rock star in that role.
Yes.
So that's good. And then a question. Do we do something similar with the Charlotte EOC?
We do not. I mean, we don't send representation to Charlotte County, but we work very closely with Charlotte County.
Okay. Yes. Okay, thank you. That's all I have.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody else?
Did you get Julie's air mattress for
I think we'll put in a resource request for her.
Yeah, they sleep on a floor last time.
She has a bunk. It's just, do you prefer to use it or not? Any other questions?
Anything else?
Thank you very much.
Thank you
I do
so
have
much.
A question related for city manager on this, and it may take the form of another agenda item somewhere else, but have we given much consideration in the event the emergency borrowing referendum fails? Have we developed any kind of a strategy for financial management of disaster recovery? In other words, after Ian, we spent an enormous amount of money, perhaps more money than it would have been prudent to spend in the event that we got hit again with a reoccurring storm afterwards. So I wonder if it would be prudent of us to, perhaps not in today's meeting, but for another workshop item or a special agenda item somewhere, to discuss our strategy financially, because I think commission, in the event we get hit with a storm, you know, it's right away, we got to clear debris, we've got to do this, that, but maybe we should have a strategy on how much of our fund balances we're willing to commit to a storm. We need to maybe have those kinds of discussions, because I would hate to see us in the same position. And I don't know how prudent it would be to expend the kind of resources we did after Ian, you know, to do that again in light of the fact that we could very easily get hit again, find ourselves in a horrible position. So we may want to prioritize the kind of relief, you know, debris, critical infrastructure that inhibits people to get around. I mean, it's just a conversation to be had, and I didn't know if staff's done any of that, or because ultimately it's us to decide how much money gets spent on this kind of stuff. So, you know, once a disaster hits, it's kind of a little late to be scrambling a strategy together. So
thank you, Mr. Mayor. So our strategy would be to use the reserves that we have in place in order to handle ourselves the same way that we did have with Ian. The only thing that would change is if we did have borrowing authority that would make you want to go in a different way to keep that money in your hands. But until we get past the decision of whether we're gonna have it or not, I don't think we would want to have a conversation with that much detail that would sort of confuse people at the same time as well. I think what you and the staff definitely want to know is that we are going to be covered, and we're going to make sure that we are not going to be put in a position to fail financially. And that's what our finance team does, is they sort of lay out the plans of how we recover. But I don't, it's up to the board, but I don't see that being a public conversation. for that particular reason.
Certainly premature at this time until the 13th comes and goes, but depending on how that goes, this may be an item to revisit at some point. But okay. Other than that, I don't have anything more. Appreciate the presentation.
Thank you.
Any public comment on this item? Moving on to B 25-2204, presentation regarding inventory list of city-owned surplus property sites that are appropriate for use as affordable housing. City Manager, your item.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. This conversation, we are going to discuss whether to move forward with placement of the list of identified surplus properties suitable for affordable housing on a regular commission agenda item if necessary. This, we know that affordable housing and the property we have is very limited, so we're going to get an overview here and get some directions from the board.
Good morning, City Commission. My name is Thomas Fiorelli. I just recently, about 9 weeks ago, moved to the state of Florida from the state of Oregon, which is where I've spent the majority of my career. I will note that I actually grew up in Florida, so I went to high school here before the high school was built. And I'm now returning back home, so it's a wonderful opportunity to be here today. I have a couple of resources that I will be sharing on the screen this morning. One of them is a map that we have developed, which shows all of these properties within their specific zoning districts. And secondly, I'm going to take a moment to navigate over to our own zoning map within the city of Northport, so I can zoom in to specific parcels for which you may have questions. Bear with me just a moment. Excellent. And while this is loading, I will bring up the map that we've developed specific for this list. You have in front of you, as well as within the agenda for members of the public, a list of the properties that we have identified under Live Local. I've also created some additional resources should those be of interest to commissioners this morning. This includes just some of my notes covering the Florida statutes and the laws that this list was developed under, as well as an attachment of the list, should folks like to have this. We will be returning to you during a regular commission meeting in order to request that you approve a resolution under the state requirements for Live Local. So a brief overview, Florida Statute 1660451 requires municipalities within the state of Florida to prepare an inventory list of all real property within its jurisdiction that the municipality owns as fee simple every 3 years. Once the inventory list is adopted through resolution, it will be required to be publicly available for entities that would like to identify those properties and develop said affordable housing. This is in compliance with the Florida statute with a primary purpose for those city-owned real property parcels to be there for independent developers, as well as those nonprofit organizations such as Habitat for Humanity, for example. And once the inventory list is adopted through resolution, it's required by state statute to, again, be available on our website so that folks can download that and see if they'd like to identify any of those parcels for development. The parcel count, we have specifically 118 parcels on this list. And this process was initially begun some time ago, early in 2024. There was engagement with all of the departments within the city of Northport. So as you can see, there is a significantly longer list than the 118 that we've identified specifically for affordable housing. Our departments, including utilities, public works, and other entities, identified parcels that would not be appropriate for affordable housing for one of many different reasons that they provided back to us. We, our staff, prior to my arrival here, I've had about the last 8 weeks that I've been here to be engaged in this process. The staff had the opportunity to work with all of those departments and identify columns within that spreadsheet which said, is it appropriate for affordable housing? And that's where we have that yes or no column. And these, again, are properties that are viable building sites. And so you'll notice there are a number of these within some of our activity centers. As you all know, we cannot build single family housing within those areas, but those would be appropriate for multifamily housing under the ULDC provisions that guide those specific jurisdiction areas. These parcels may be utilized through long-term lease, through sale, or through donation by the city to an affordable housing developer. In the R1 zoning district, just to quantify this for you, there are 88 properties within the R1 district. So the vast majority of that 118 list of properties would largely be single family residential homes, of which some of them, depending on the way that legislation moves forward, may be able to develop an accessory dwelling units in the future, if and when that happens at the state level. In the R2 zoning district, there are 4 properties. In the R3 zoning district, there are 2 properties. And within corridor, there are 3 properties. So again, those would likely be multifamily housing. In corridor transitional, slightly more. We have 17 properties within that specific district. Within Activity Center 3, which I alluded to a few moments ago, there is 1 property, just 1, that would be appropriate for affordable housing. In Activity Center 6, there would be 2 properties appropriate for affordable housing. In Activity Center 1, once again, just 1 property that would be appropriate for affordable housing. And again, I'll direct your attention to the screen and also for members of the public who would like to see where these properties actually fall within our zoning map. And as I noted a few moments ago, I also do have the zoning map available here, and I could search for specific properties if commissioners have questions about any of them in particular. I'll also note again, just for the record, that we will be back again for a regular commission meeting in order to present to you the resolution. The intent of today's meeting is to show you the properties that have been identified and ask if you have any questions or feedback for us.
I have a question. I'm reviewing the list, and I just have a few questions about the list. So the first couple of pages are highlighted in yellow.
That's correct.
I might have missed. Are these the ones that are most appropriate?
That is correct.
Okay. In looking at the list, I mean, and I think I heard you say, and I want to confirm, that any housing development in any zoning that's activity center would have to be a multi-family development, no single family homes.
That is correct.
Okay. And then I see some of these. So I'm looking at, no, it doesn't matter, but an R1 residential with a yes for development, I think, but it's drainage reservoir. Wouldn't that disqualify a property from residential development, or should it?
As a point of clarification, is it one of the ones that's highlighted? Great. So those are ones that our public works folks have looked at and determined that they would not need to reserve that or keep that off the list. So this did get vetted by other departments. But if you would give me the PID that you're specifically referencing, the purpose of this meeting is absolutely to take those questions and just double check if there's anything that you are concerned about.
Yeah, if I'm reading this correctly, so there's one. Again, I printed it out and it's very small. Okay. PID 0971 13-1223. It's identified as drainage reservoir. So would that be potentially identified for, oh, my goodness.
I have friends.
Yeah.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. The list downloaded and provided incorporates the county's designated land use types, and the county has a tendency to identify those land use types not based on our zoning, but based on the ownership. And so if the Northport Road and Drainage District owns that property, they identify them as drainage reservoirs.
Okay, so it might not be underwater property, it's just...
Correct, correct. So our Road and Drainage District did review this list, and they did reserve some parcels that they know are needed for future stormwater, right, or for expansion of existing stormwater areas.
Okay. And I would also hope that any property in a corridor or any other zoning type that equals commercial would not be developed for housing. That would just be my preference. Let me put it out there. There seems to be plenty of other properties that we wouldn't have to target the six that through a lot of pain, sweat, and bleeding, we converted to commercial properties. I don't want to see residential.
Right. Does our live local law allow us?
There, our code right now requires the corridor and corridor transitional to be mixed use if residential is incorporated.
Right.
There are some bills that have been approved in the legislature that modify the Live Local Act and open up mixed use properties intended for mixed use to the Live Local Act, but they also incorporate a requirement for 10% commercial. So moving forward, we'll see if the governor signs those bills, in which case we will be preempted and only allowed to enforce that 10% commercial.
Wonderful.
Lori, have they passed both the House and the Senate? I'm sorry.
Yes.
They have. I knew they were moving along. I just didn't know if they made it through both. So it's going, they're going to the governor's desk.
Yes, okay. Sir.
Thank you.
Anything else, commissioners? Commissioner Duval.
As I did a quick look at that map that you had up, I kind of looked at one area, and I saw a little dot on here. Can you see where it says Largo Preserve at the bottom middle of the screen?
Yes, sir. Right above the word Largo.
Okay. And there's a spot right there. I'm going to have to look that one up after the meeting to see exactly what it is. But that looks like Sadnet Lane. As far as I know, that is a single family zoned area. And how are we going to put affordable housing?
So a majority of the sites are within the single family residential districts. Affordable housing, as you all very well know, is based on the area median income. So anything from 30% all the way up to 60% AMI is typically what we call affordable housing, with 60 to 120 being in what we typically call workforce housing range. We could absolutely, and organizations such as Habitat for Humanity, those which operate within cities that have predominantly single family neighborhoods, and that's what the housing mix is really desired in terms of what the citizens are looking for. They do build those types of houses, and they do develop contracts so they can place families within those homes within single family districts. So we want a mix of housing essentially that provides affordable housing to all of the different typologies that people would be looking for, whether they have a family and they would like a yard, or they prefer to live in an apartment complex and be more along the multifamily type.
So you're saying that it would still be a single family home that would be.
Yes, absolutely. So I don't want to imply that affordable housing means you'd have any density greater than single family. As I mentioned, the 88 properties here, the vast majority of the ones on this list would be single family residences if and until there's actually the law that's passed allowing for an accessory dwelling unit on each property. Then that's the only time you'd actually see some middle housing or anything with two units or above.
Thank you.
Anything else? All right. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
We look forward to bringing this back. And we have any public comment on this? We'll move right along to C25-2093. Presentation and possible direction on a proposed assessment for Tamiami Trail linear parking. City Manager, this is your item.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. On this presentation, we'll restart the conversation regarding the parking that we know on Tamiami Trail that has been ongoing for multiple years, but we're going to provide you our latest updates and information that we have. And I will now turn over to the Assistant Public Works Director, Ms. Tricia Wisner. Thank you, ma'am.
You're welcome. Good morning. Tricia Wisner, Deputy Director of Public Works. With me, I have Vita Quinn, SCS Engineering, and she will go through the methodology as to how we got to the technical report, and then we're all here to answer questions. Just give me 1 second to get this. IT. Beeping, but it won't let me click on it. I see it. Call in the help. That one. And then the drive two, which is my USB. So if it's not working here, although I ran it here this morning. I always feel better when IT people come up and press one button to make it happen. So
that's pretty good.
Thank you. Want to try to launch it from the drive?
Yes, we try.
Cool. Thank you.
I'm Vita Quinn, Director of Management Services for SCS. We worked on this assessment for you all, so I just wanted to walk through the methodology basically today, how we got to where we are, and next steps and get some recommendations. The basis for the assessment was that you do have a number of businesses along Tamiami Trail that don't have sufficient parking for the types of uses of those businesses. You're looking at installing parking along that frontage road there. And the easiest way to recover those costs from the property owners is by means of a non-ad valorem special assessment. So just so you get an idea, this is the map of the area. I'll show you all the businesses that will be benefiting from the parking, parking being along that roadway on either side in front of those businesses. Non-ad valorem assessments, I know you're familiar with this, but just as a refresher, can be used to cover the cost of these capital improvements. The basis for an assessment, how it differs from a fee, is it's based on special benefit provided to those properties, and therefore the costs that are to be put into that assessment are apportioned on the basis of benefit or relief of burden, not on the property values as would your taxes. The special benefits that are really being received by the properties that are to be assessed here is that there will be additional parking, which means increased ease of access to the property. And in the longer term, that actually increases property values as well as rental values of those parcels. The cost that preliminary, I'm going to go ahead and say up front, everything in here is preliminary. The engineering costs have been quoted, but some of these other things are assumptions that we're going off of, but this is our best estimate at this point. So you have some of the construction costs and the cost to install parking meters, which we'll get to in a minute, how that might factor into this assessment, is $2.2 to $2.3 million. There's another additional probably $100,000 in costs or anticipated to be annual maintenance costs for the parking spaces and meters. It's important to note in that right column with the totals is the annual cost. So rather than trying to pay for all the capital costs up front or to assume that you're borrowing necessarily, we are just amortizing those costs over the useful life of those parking spaces and the parking meters. The methodology that we chose, again, we're looking for how best to apportion the benefit being received by these properties, is to look really at who's going to be using the parking spaces. And parking really has to do with the number of trips that a business is generating, right? So you have some restaurants in there, high turnover, lots of patrons throughout the day, whereas you might have some that would be just a small office building, less likely to need as much additional parking because there just aren't as many cars coming and going throughout the day. So based on the, getting in the weeds a little bit, Institute of Transportation Engineers has trip generation rates based on property uses. I'll just leave it at that. But we calculate then the anticipated trips for each property based on the size of the building and the trips generated per 1,000 square feet. And then we look at what the business's net parking requirement would be, meaning that most of these businesses do have parking available to them. It just may not be sufficient for the number of trips that are generated through a day. So we would take the number of trips anticipated less the parking spaces available to them, whatever remains would be their net parking requirement. There were a few assumptions that we had to make because of businesses that don't traditionally have all of their patrons parking. The drive-through banks, you may have about half of those customers that will actually park and go inside, the other half going through the tellers, never really requiring parking spaces. Same can be said for car washes and gas stations. While those parking spaces there may be utilized somewhat, it's not a regular requirement. So there's very little of those trips generated by that business that would really require additional parking spaces. And then when we started to look at how to formulate the assessment, there was another question of how easy is this going to be to understand and to administer and maintain every year? Meaning that every year you have to go back in and make sure that you're assessing these properties the right amounts, and business uses do change over time. We know what the list of businesses currently is, what the property uses currently are, but as those things might change over time, it might become a little more difficult. So we had the concept of looking at restaurant uses versus non-restaurant uses. The primary reason for that being, as I mentioned earlier, restaurants do tend to generate more trips in a day, but also they require a significant amount of tenant improvements, meaning that you have to install kitchen, grease traps, special equipment, things like that, that make it highly unlikely that what is a restaurant today is going to be an accountant's office tomorrow, and vice versa. Buildings that don't have these improvements are highly unlikely in the near future to be turned into a restaurant. So we looked at a methodology where we calculated it based on current use, but also as well as average use by class, again, restaurant versus non-restaurant. And then now back to the parking meters. There are about 150 spaces that are going to be there. And the concept would be that if you install parking meters, those spaces would be used at least somewhat during the day, and that would generate some revenue that might serve to offset some of the costs of the assessment. So this slide really just shows you the anticipated annual revenue for those parking meters. And the assumption, given the current calculations, is that as long as those meters are utilized about 11% of the time, it would be a net benefit to the properties that are paying that assessment. These are what the assessments would turn out to be per billable trip. So again, based on that methodology, for however many trips each parcel would generate, or net trips, with and without parking meters, based on actual and average trip generation, you can see that it doesn't vary a lot. It's about a dollar difference, but it the average trip generation being just an easier way to kind of look at and understand that assessment. And that's really all I have to say as far as the methodology. Now, understanding, like I mentioned, this is kind of the first step in the process. These costs are not finalized, but it's really more to get some input from all of you regarding the methodology and you know what you see being most feasible going forward. Understanding that our recommendation is, though, that you would assess 100% of the cost associated with this so that you're recovering those through the businesses that are benefiting. And I'll take any questions.
Commissioners. Mr. Duval.
Yes. Down near the corner of Biscayne, 41, across from the Northport Library, there are some parking spaces there. Who pays for those?
I have heard there are parking spaces. I have people that will tell you that. City.
Chuck Speak, Public Works Director. So there are some linear parking spaces that were installed in a project earlier that the city had done that were paid for through surtax.
Kind of expanding a little bit. During our public comment, former commissioner, mentioned surtax money. Has this genuinely been totally decided in the past that we're not using surtax money for this project? We're definitely going to be assessing, or is this up to us to decide what we're going to do?
So I can answer that.
And decide.
Right. So this is bringing back. There was a request by commission to bring back funding options for this. Road and drainage funds, 107 funds, aren't qualified for this. Transportation impact fees can't be used for this.
Cannot.
It has to increase the capacity of our network, our roadway network. This does not do that, right? So these parking spaces benefit those businesses more than they do the city and every resident within the city, right? So that's what precludes that road and drainage district funds as well. And I'm assuming that's why they paid originally with surtax the last time. So it was funded somewhat through surtax. I knew design was back in 16, I think this project started or switched over to 19. And then some funds were pulled back out of it. And that's when commission decided to prioritize other projects in front of this one.
As far as prioritization, I noticed when I was looking and the lady just mentioned also, that we will be keeping track in the future of the uses of some of the properties. Like some of the properties are vacant right now, but maybe someone's going to build a store and put a business in there. And will they then be, you know, will we look at things again and, you know, and add them to the assessment?
This would have to be updated regularly. Okay. It's just like our methodologies for any other assessment that we do.
And then installing parking meters. As far as I know, we don't have any parking meters in the city of Northport.
No, sir.
If we do this for this, how do I put this? I guess, do those business owners have a complaint that, hey, wait a minute, our customers have to pay a fee? That can hurt our business a little bit. What about other customers at other parking areas around the city? You know, do we have an issue there of deciding where and when we'll put parking meters?
Again, parking meters were one of the things brought up when we had this discussion. So we looked into that. Personally, parking meters are kind of a maintenance and enforcement challenge for a city. And to have just that few parking meters, we would have to hire someone to maintain those. You know, PD would have to enforce. You have to weigh that versus what they would actually bring in. But it is an offsetting revenue for these parking spaces.
Also, you can thank my wife for this. She said, like, oh, are you going to need to hire a meter maid?
Likely.
Likely?
Yes.
Okay, that's all I've got for questions.
Vice Mayor.
Yep, since we're on the subject of the meter maid, on your one chart, that $78,000 under maintenance, would that be for the position of the meter rate? See? That's what I was struggling. And then on that same chart, it was $250 an hour. To park there?
Yes.
Is that a national going rate at this point, or is that just a number
St.
you
Augustine.
Just came up with?
That's what I pay a lot.
Well, the reason I ask is, are they automotive, you know, automatic to where you put it on a card and then you get charged for the time you're there, or you got to run out every hour and put $250 in?
No, this was these are all assumptions, but our research was done based on those kiosks that you're used to seeing now where you pay at the kiosk, not putting in quarters anymore.
Right, for however many hours you choose at that time.
Well, the reason I ask is Commissioner Duvall brought up a good point. When you're at, like, let's say a restaurant, and I'm going to use Anna Maria Oyster Bar as an example, you could have an hour wait outside trying to get in to have your dinner. Then you have your dinner. You could be in there for 2 to 3 hours, and now you just added $750 to the cost of their meal by having to park there. To where in other areas, you don't have that. Now, since I'm on Anna Maria Oyster Bar and the Moose specifically, that's where one of our hugest parking problems are, you know, with damage to the swales and stuff in the rainy season. Would they both have the same need. Would they share the same type of cost towards that going in? Or would one, let's just say the Moose may have a little less impact than Anna Maria Oyster Bar does. How does that get divvied up there if everybody's fighting over those same parking spots?
Sure.
To get in.
And I can let you answer that. It's square footage.
Well, in terms of using those spaces, that's just going to be first come, first serve.
No, I understand that, but the assessment to the business.
The assessment is the net assumed trips. So let's say Anna Maria generates 100 trips, but it has 50 parking spaces available to it. It's going to get billed for those assumed additional 50 trips. But let's say the Moose only generates 30 trips, and it has 20 spaces available to it. That would be 10 that would be left over that would be assessed for. So it's based on the assumption of, we did some GIS and overhead analysis and looked at the parking spaces available to each business and just calculated the number of those additional spaces that they would really need to use.
Okay, but we also have other businesses down that same roadway. When we're looking at this, are we just looking at small sections? Or are we looking at doing that whole roadway, let's say between Northport Boulevard and I can't remember the name of that road, but where the hotel is? Are we going to make that whole section parking rather than just the corner for the existing super need right now?
So if you look at the overhead on your screens, all of the highlighted businesses would have parking in front of them. So it would run that stretch from Northport over to the motel, at the spot you're speaking of.
Okay, but on those vacant parcels, would there be no parking there, or would that be included to go as we're doing it? Are we going to do it all, or are we just going to piecemeal it, put parking here, parking, and then move down and put parking
the
here?
The parking will run the entire length.
Okay. And then the vacant properties, they could possibly be assessed for the areas right in front of them, or no?
Once a business came in.
Yeah, vacant parcels are assumed to not generate any trips. So there wouldn't be an assessment based on there not being any benefit at the time. But once the parcel is developed, yes.
Okay, and this is the last thing I got, Mayor. When we're talking about surtax or meters or anything like that, we, and like Commissioner DeVall brought up, we don't have meters anywhere else. We don't have the maintenance for meters. We're not going to create another position to watch these meters. Surtax seems to be the viable answer to get this done, and I'll tell you why. These businesses are the ones that are generating the sales tax that's coming into surtax. So by their business itself, they're generating the surtax funds to be able to be used back on the business. Now, I've always said, why should tax money help a private business? To me now, it's the private business is helping to pay for their escalating needs, especially in parking. So when we come back again, those are some of the discussions we need to have, because I'm really not in favor of $250 an hour parking. I'm not in favor of having meters out there and having to maintain them. It's just like we're adding more to the problem, to where if we just set aside funding, get it done, then we move on. Yeah, you may have to sweep it out every once in a while with the street sweeper. You're doing the roads anyways. Just whip in there and do it. I think it's a lot less complicated, and everybody will benefit from it, not only the businesses, but the patrons and this, that, and the other. Because, I mean, after you get done eating dinner in the rainy season, you got to walk out to your car, and you're parked right next to a ditch. I mean, how comfortable is that when you had a nice night out with your loved one? So I see the need, and I'd like to get it resolved somehow down the road. That's all I had there.
Thank you, Commissioner Langdon.
Yeah, I'm really struggling with this. And philosophically, I have no issue with the businesses chipping in. I have no issue with paid parking. Let me tell you, Anna Maria Oyster Bar isn't cheap. You go there for dinner, a few more bucks for parking. So philosophically, I'm good with all of it. But here's what I've also been thinking about. All of these businesses are in an area that we really want to be commercially viable. We've rezoned, we've done a lot of things to stimulate economic development in these areas. And I'm assuming that any new commercial development is done so with adequate parking. I'm looking at Miss Elena. You don't have to come down. She's nodding. So safe assumption. So these are all the older businesses in the area. I could easily see in a few years some of these properties being bought up, torn down, and something else built. So what am I getting at? All along Tamiami, we're going to have this issue of how do we stimulate and balance economic development and rehabbing, honestly, of the area with implementing business-unfriendly policies. I'm just trying to reconcile this in my mind. And a few months ago, I was much clearer on what I thought we should do. But the experience with Anna Maria Oyster Bar, they have done so much to really improve the quality of life in the city, why should we punish them by making them pay for parking? And again, at a philosophical level, if these businesses chip in, I really don't have an issue with that. But to leave them holding the bag and setting a precedent for what's going to be an issue up and down Tamiami, I mean, at least until you get to, you know, Coco Plum and some of those newer developments along Tamiami, I just want to make sure that whatever we do along this older stretch of Tamiami, that we're fair and consistent with what we do. And I hadn't really considered that that other, you know, across the street strip of retail that got their parking benefit of surtax, no cost to them. What we're proposing here just seems inequitable to me. And again, philosophically, I have no problem with any of it. And I am supportive of paid for parking, but I think we maybe need to think bigger. We talked of, so it's, what is our parking strategy gonna be all up and down Tamiami where these older businesses exist? Knowing that we want to see this area revitalized, are we going to do something today to solve a $2 million problem that's really going to become unmanageable and inequitable as we move forward into the future? A few months ago, we were sort of talking about a parking strategy for the city. I don't know if we've done any work on that. I was trying to remember, did we make a motion or did we really direct staff to work on that? And I don't remember. You might remember, Chuck.
This is part of that.
This is
right.
Part of
this was our first, this is our first parking project that we have that's been on the books that has not been funded or was funded and reprioritized. So
right.
As part of that, this is the beginning of that holistic parking, that look at it.
Right.
I will tell you that that the initial parking, the angled parking that was built for the college, really is why it was built initially on the other side further down,
right,
came in at a cost of about $300,000.
Right.
So, you know, we're talking much bigger numbers now.
Right.
And that's why we're here, is for direction,
right,
as far as the board and which way they want to go.
Right.
As far as surtax or these assessments, and those are your options. There's not really... like I said, transportation impact fees won't cover this. Your funding sources are very limited, and surtax, again, is very stretched. So
This
is just another option to try to fill that void.
From a policy perspective, you know, I mentioned adopting the assessment at 100% would be what would cover all these costs, but definitely worked with other municipalities where they negotiate with the business owners, because the business owners are likely going to say that they would like this done rather than tabled for now. So They might be willing to contribute toward this project. Maybe there's a way to negotiate a portion of that. Trying to remember the city of Sarasota when we were looking at something with St. Armand Circle, but I believe at the time they were negotiating with the businesses there to cover basically a portion of the debt service on the project they were borrowing for that. But you can see where you can just agree on a portion and maybe fund ongoing maintenance or something else through the surtaxes. I mean, there's a number of different ways you could look at this. It just cannot be more than 100% that you assess those businesses. It could be as low as one.
Right. And just a couple of thoughts. So again, we'll pick on Anna Maria. Would we, so if Anna Maria kicks in, however we figure that out, will there be a sign saying this parking is for Anna Maria customers?
The entire parking will be first come, first serve. Right? So the entire stretch will be first come, first serve.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, you have some businesses to the south that generate very little parking. You have some vacant lots to the south. So it's going to open, you know, a good portion of spots through there.
And I have to wonder, again, I'm looking at the map and I'm seeing some undeveloped lots, just a few parcels down from Anna Maria and the Chamber and the Moose Lodge, would it be more cost effective to buy those and make it parking?
They're privately owned. I don't think that that, that owner
expensive.
Would be looking to do that.
Yeah.
We've had contact with that owner.
Yeah.
They work with the city in a lot of different ways, but they're not interested in turning that into a parking lot.
Yeah,
it's unlikely that would be the highest and best use.
Today, and again, I'm still all over the place on this. I'll be honest. I'm usually not so wishy-washy, but I'm just sort of, I mean, this is an area we really want to revitalize and rehab, and I'm reluctant to do anything that's punitive to current or future businesses. But right now I'm sort of thinking, well, what if we did a hybrid? So let's hold on paid parking, although philosophically I have no objection to that. Hold on paid parking, and maybe the city should pay some of it. I'm talking just capital costs. The businesses pay some of it. But boy, you have a good memory, Chuck, and you might remember at one point, didn't the city receive a grant to do some parking improvements in this area?
If I remember correctly, that was for design, and that's what helped design this project in the beginning.
Okay.
Now it's been redesigned since, but yeah. I believe there's some design funds at one point.
Well, I don't have that. Anything else but to say I still have a lot of angst on this issue.
Vice Mayor, you have, you said you had a question or two.
Yeah, you can go for it.
Okay. All right. I get a question. In calculating the trips per day, how do you do that? Is it based on the type of business? Okay.
It's the type of business and the trips generated per 1,000 square feet. So it's the size of the building.
And that's based on like a what a statewide, nationwide, how, where
the
does...
Institute of Transportation Engineers
good.
Does these trip generation
good.
Studies.
Gotcha.
We try to choose ones wherever possible that are better studied because some of them may only have one or two instances of it. But we try to choose property uses that are fairly common, that have been fairly well studied, and then we use those
gotcha.
To base these trips
right.
on.
And no consideration given to virtual parking systems at all. We're talking like the meters, you know, I mean, I've been places where you pay by app. There's this little tiny sign. It's got a 8-digit number on it. You put that in, you download the app, pay by phone. It's called, I have it on my phone. I use it if I'm in, you know, somewhere like say Fort Lauderdale or wherever. And I thought it was incredible. No meters,
right.
No infrastructure, no nothing to take care of. No bupkey. They got cameras which shoot it, so you don't even need a meter made.
You can
sit in your restaurant, and if you're waiting to get your table and you need to extend the time, you do it right on your app. And that's another avenue that has no maintenance cost to speak of going forward. So there was no consideration in that. This is just looking at meters. But I can't think of, how can I say this? Government does a great, no, I don't want to say it that way either. I would say that I can't really think of anything about this that makes sense to me. I travel this multiple times a day. There are, on one hand, I can count the businesses that have parking problems. No one else, anywhere else that's highlighted here has any parking problems whatsoever, any time of day or night, weekends, you name it, never. There's the Mexican restaurant, Blue Tequila. There's maybe Shark or whatever that place is.
Sharkies.
No, there's not Sharkies. There's a seafood sharks restaurant. You got Anna Marie. You got the Moose. I can't think of another business that's impacted at all by parking in any way, shape, or form. And this... the only people who I've ever heard who have brought up this parking problem has been, you know,
from basically quality TV on up to the Oyster Bar, and there's only a couple of them, to impose an assessment on these people, on their customers or their businesses, is, as Commissioner Langdon said, thank you very much for doing great and contributing to our city. A couple, 200,000 to 300,000, I believe, was I wouldn't say stolen, as ex-commissioner Luke said, but reappropriated elsewhere, and that came out of surtax. This is a perfect surtax project, as Vice Mayor said. I think it should all be paid for by surtax. I think we should look at the surtax list and reprioritize some of those projects anyway, because there's money in surtax that are going to projects that I don't think are nearly as beneficial to the city as helping to improve the economic climate along this corridor. So I would be more in favor of doing something like that. I think there's a whole host of businesses here that would not benefit one iota from parking spots. And if you tried to assess them, well, as many people as we already have who think that there is no brains within City Hall, this would just contribute to that narrative all the more. I just can't even imagine in any way, shape, or form that this makes any kind of sense. And yet I appreciate that there's a little bit of a parking problem, but you want to know something? They're all parking parallel now. They're not parking in at angles. They're not parking into the swales. And if they have to, they're parking down past Mike's place at Quality Order. They're walking 100, 200 feet or 200 yards if they have to get up to the restaurant. And you know what? Maybe that's just how it should be for the time being. Because I don't see how this makes sense in any way. If we wanted to spend a couple of million dollars of surtax money, I sure wouldn't have a problem, because I consider this a little more priority than some of the other surtax lists. But that's just my personal opinion. So I don't know. I mean, I appreciate the work that went into doing this,
but boy,
you know, and Commissioner Lang made a good point. As a city, we've got issues. I think it's horrible to think that, you know, here in an area that, you know, we got a brand new restaurant that comes in and it's doing gangbuster business, and their customers are either going to get penalized or the business is going to get penalized for doing well, when right across the street where Austin's is going to be now a new Asian restaurant and they got a big parking lot and they're not going to pay Bubke. And, you know, like, if I'm making a choice, there's going to be some people, I'll just go there. Why should I pay that extra money? You know, and I don't know. I mean,
it's a struggle.
Yeah, I just.
So, Mayor, that's why we're here today.
You got it. I know your direction. And they know how this all came about, too. So I know. Yeah, we had a handful of patrons there who asked for it because they're perceiving the problem. But if you were to go to that four or five businesses and ask them what they think of this, I would say they'd be more apt to say, you know what, let's just leave it the way it is. We're okay with that. That's what you're going to get. Anyway, that's all I have to say on this. Mr. Duval.
Parking meters. I just don't like that idea. Parking meters. Unfortunately, I look at this area, and I'm one of those people that Oyster Bar. My dentist's office is there. Car insurance company there. Came out of my dentist's office one day, and I had to get a cable out of my truck and hook it to my trailer hitch and pull a car back up the swale. An elderly lady put the car in the wrong direction and went down into the swale. It is a problem. You know, El Naro's, you know, that's another one of my favorite little places. It is a problem, and we do need that parking. We do need this project done. And more and more, just listening to my fellow commissioners, listening to what you folks have to say, listening to former Commissioner Luke, that idea of surtax money is looking looking more likely to be, just my opinion.
So if I could say something, I will tell you that the reason the parking meters came into that conversation was the question of whether those spaces could essentially pay for themselves. How much would it take to mitigate the need for that assessment entirely? And I believe, I don't have it in front of me, the answer would be if they were utilized more than a third of the time, maybe 35% of the time, you wouldn't have anyone needing to pay an assessment. So just think of that. Depending on how heavily utilized those spaces are, it may really mean that the businesses don't have to pay very much. But people would, I understand that.
Thank you. Vice Mayor.
Yeah, just a couple other things. When y'all bring back some more information, I think you pretty much heard what we've leaned on up here too. But another aspect of this is we've seen where the priority may tend to lie, to where if we did this in phases and did the one section, like I said, between Norport Boulevard and the hotel, phase one, get all those costs together, what would that cost? If we were to assess a business a cost or whatever, maybe what we assess is the cost of the maintenance of that parking area rather than the city going out having to maintain it. Or if we do maintain it, then we recoup costs for having to, because they got to maintain their own parking lots now. If this is extra parking, if they maintain it, it costs less on the city. You know, just options to look at to come back to where we can think about it, decide. We don't have to do it all at once. We see a specific need. How are we going to fix it? And then maybe after phase one, we can jump right into phase two or wait a couple years, because they still don't have an issue in phase two at that point. So it's hard to predict the future, but you know, if it's half the price, now we're only looking at a little over $1 million to do one of these areas. You know, it chops it down a little bit and it still gets the work done. That's all I'm thinking of for our next conversation.
Sure. So if I can get some clear direction for our next conversation on what you would like to see us bring back, and phasing the project, that's fairly easy. We can break that up into the three different phases. It would help us dial it in a little better for our next meeting.
It would be, I mean, the areas, as Vice Mayor said, from the hotel to Northport Boulevard that runs along where Anna Marie and the Moose are, that is probably the most critical. Also, the piece across from the Mexican restaurant Blue Tequila. I mean, it's not bad, but in high season, they're parked on that access road, and it really isn't bad. I mean, they park parallel on the access road, and I don't know that it's causing anybody any problem there, but there's no real parking spots. You know, cars still traverse it, and they're just parking parallel. And then Alvaro's, which I forgot about, that's the other piece. They do park right up along the swale. I mean, you know, on a Saturday, you're right, because you've got the dentist office. There's a parking lot right next to it that, you know, I park in Saturday morning when I go eat breakfast there after Meals on Wheels, because their businesses are closed. But during the week, I'll see people along. So there's those three sections. If we just look at where the restaurants are, that's where the problem is. The other businesses don't have a problem. Not that I'm aware of.
So are we leaning towards surtax funding?
I mean,
that's kind of what I've heard there.
I mean, I truly believe that's the right bucket to go looking for money.
I would say at least for the capital costs,
yeah.
Sort of the
yeah,
initial.
And the maintenance piece. Yeah, you know, Vice Mayor had a good idea maybe on maintenance.
Yes, going along with that, I say, you know, surtax start with, and then at maintenance, you know, maybe a hybrid in the maintenance where, you know, the business can kick in for the maintenance cost. So you have kind of like a hybrid.
If I can just add to the maintenance cost. So if the city takes the capital side of that project, right, construction, we've already worked through design. We take the capital side of that project and we do not put in parking meters, right? Maintenance is going to be at such a minimum that the time and energy spent on putting together the agreements or the methodology
wouldn't be worth it.
Yeah,
just like nothing to it.
Right.
So I would personally, because we would have to put that together, Michael would have to go through it. I think, I just don't think that would be a a good investment of our time.
I think we said sweeping was $575 a month, so pretty minimal.
Probably a year.
Yeah, I had probably a year.
For sweeping those little spots. But it would be very, very minimal. And you would spend more on staff time putting those agreements together and having them executed.
City Manager, I saw your hand start to go up.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Mayor. I would say that as we come to you with your budget information in the upcoming weeks, we'll make sure that we have the surtax on there, the list, as you said, you want to review to see if you want to rearrange the priorities on that list as it currently stands.
Yep, perfect.
And from what I understand, we're going to bring back then some phasing options for construction, which may break that number down. If you decide to go surtax, it may be a lesser number for some of the areas that you would like to have done first.
Yeah, like Vice Mayor said, if we knew by section, because that'll cut that number down fairly significantly.
Yeah, because if you look at it, you got three different possibilities here, three different areas. So
correct.
A cost per area would be, you know, this way we can look at it. You never know, we might be able to knock out two, but I'm hoping to knock out one. That's the starting point.
Do you, I mean, I don't know how appropriate Mr. Speaks, but as you look at the city at large, do you see other areas, especially probably along the Toledo Blade area, where this could eventually become an issue? Because Commissioner Langdon made a good point. As development takes place, we've sort of done a better job, you know, with the issue of parking, and as new businesses come on board in undeveloped areas or even redeveloped areas, you know, the proper, you know, adequate parking is provided for it. So it doesn't seem like it's as big a problem as it is in some of these older commercial sections.
Right, you're just going to run into this problem in the older sections. The Development Services has a real good plan for parking now and requirements for new businesses coming in to accommodate the needs of their customers. It's just in these older sections that have been repurposed over the years and now are a little crowded.
We want to do everything we can to make it attractive for the redevelopment of those areas.
Yes, ma'am.
Need anything else from us?
No, sir.
Good conversation.
And thank you very much for the efforts on this.
I
appreciate this. This is one of those that's just been kicking around for a long time and we need to get it addressed. City Clerk. Public comment. There you go.
There he is.
Just squeaked in under the wire there.
Good morning, Mike Morales, Northport. So, previous commission, I know obviously you may or may not know, so I just wanted to bring your attention to that. Obviously, I was involved with Bloat, which was the business owners of Tamiami Trail, right? And we ended up getting in for a grant from the state, which the city did get, I believe it was $250,000 to take care of this parking that was needed for when General Development donated it for that purpose. And obviously it started at the library and on the other side of Pan American, but then just stopped. So I've heard some question about, you know, making the businesses pay for this, but we got $250,000 from the businesses that we worked to do that, to get that to the city so you guys could take it to the next step. And no one knows. I still have not yet found where that money went. I'm sure it went for something that was more important or a need at the time or whatever, but I'd like to see if we can get those funds in place of putting that burden on the businesses to take care of this parking need that's in great demand, as you know. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Anything else? Let's move on to our final item. D25-2124, presentation and possible direction on the facility condition assessment. City Manager, it's yours.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I will turn it back over to our Public Works Leadership Team. Deputy Director, Mr. Wisdom.
All right. Good morning, Commissioners. Tricia Wisner, Deputy Director of Public Works. This is definitely one of those not new conversations. We've been talking about this for a while. We're aware that there's deferred maintenance issues within the facilities, and we had been given direction to start with a facility condition assessment. We were ready to kick off that assessment, actually had a meeting in late September, and then Hurricane Ian made landfall. With the damage that Hurricane Ian did to the buildings, it just did not make sense to try to run parallel facility condition assessment. We kept the Hurricane Ian claims and damages separate, worked through those, and then relaunched this project in August of 2024. So this project started with a couple weeks of on-site work. We had staff from Alpha come out. They evaluated each facility with our facility maintenance team walking with them. Not only did they look at the physical, the visuals, but they looked at the records of maintenance. They talked about the wear and tear of the different buildings and what how the systems are used to kind of get a comprehensive view of what kind of condition everything was in and how we're using them. They categorized all of our items. These are pretty standard categorizations from high, medium, and low. So we have the high priority things, roofing, electrical, HVAC. The medium priority things are doors, windows, sprinklers, and the low priorities are the finishes and the aesthetics of the building. So they took all that information back and started to work on a report for us. Now the goal of the report is multi-layered. One, we need to know where we are so that we can develop a clean budget going forward. We also need to evaluate what the priorities are and what our process is going to be to avoid growing deferred maintenance to this level again. So looking at it both from how to address what's currently going on to a better view for the future. The first thing that the Alpha team did was develop a facility condition index. They did it both by for each individual building that they looked at, and again, they looked at just about 50 buildings throughout the city, and it compares the total cost of what they saw we need to address to what it would cost to just rebuild the building. That's just to give you a percentage as to what condition that building is in. So if we had a building that was worth $10 million and it had $2 million worth of deferred maintenance that needed to be addressed, that gives it a 20% facility condition index, FCI. They take that and then they apply it to pretty industry standard ratings. So this isn't something that they develop for us. This is pretty common across how you evaluate buildings. So good is 0 to 5%, fair is 5 to 10%, poor is 10 to 30%, and greater than 30%, you're in a critical situation where you need to be evaluating that building to see if the building is worth putting money into or what your next steps are for that building. Right now, the city is in the poor, just starting to be in the poor range for overall with our facilities. Now, some of our facilities are better than others, but if you just average us out, we're at 11%. That is based on current needs for 2025. If we go to 2030 and we don't address those needs, we'll obviously have more things that will, you know, be coming at the end of their life cycle or will need to be addressed. And the Alpha then combines those together for 2030, we get to the 17% range for the city overall. They broke out those needs by those priority levels that we had talked about earlier. So roofs and those things are the high priority, fire sprinklers are medium, and finishes like walls and floors are the lower priority. You can see that in 2025, we have about just under $10 million in high priority items that need to be addressed. That number increases to over $13 million in 2030. This gives us a good idea of how it continues to grow year over year if we're not adequately addressing those needs. So why are we having this conversation? Because it's budget season, and we're going to be coming to you with budget requests. Right now, our budget is going over to the city manager's office, and it currently has about $2 million in operating that is being added to the facilities maintenance division budget to address really some of those high needs. Now, we saw in the previous slide that that number is like $9-10 million. So why aren't we budgeting that? Well, one, our budget would not be able to handle that kind of a skew. Also, we are trying to make sure that we align the budget request with the resources we have either for our staff to handle it internally or for our staff to manage contractors. We wouldn't be in a position right now to handle $10 million worth of extra work next year. Does it need to get addressed? It does. So in the upcoming years following that, we'll continue to incrementally add more money to this fund to be prepared to handle some of these projects and to make sure that we're bringing our facilities up to an agreed upon level. We also recommend something that hasn't really happened in the past, at least consistently, making sure that we have a repair and replacement fund for these facilities. So not only are we asking for money to address what needs to be fixed, we're saying, let's start putting money aside for the future so that we don't have these huge swings in budget to address these. So the report that's attached itemizes or indicates that industry standard is 2 to 4% of the value of your building. So you take the cumulative value of all city buildings, add it together, and 2 to 4% is what you should be squirreling away every year so that you can address these things and they don't cause huge swings in your budget. So that would be about 2.2 million to 4.5 million. Again, that's just the R&R fund. So we're here today to give you a heads up that this is something that we're asking the city manager's office to include in the budget that goes forward to the city commission. And it is something that is out there that we're going to need to address in the near future. And we're here for any questions.
Mr. Langdon.
Thank you, Mayor. This is something I'm really a stickler on. And if we don't put aside, so new construction, if we don't put aside money to maintain something new, then we shouldn't build it. That's how I feel. And whether it's a police headquarters or a new utility building or a new park, if we're not putting money aside to maintain that asset, don't build it. So we need to do it. There's no question in my mind, except we do have a small R&R budget line item, don't we? I know a few years ago we had this conversation during the budget cycle, and we didn't have an R&R line.
We put $97,000 in there one year. Right. So it definitely doesn't meet the 2 to 4%, and that right. Those funds I think were
we
utilized elsewhere. Yes,
we might be able to paint.
Might be able to paint.
Okay, that's it. I mean, that's how I feel about it. There's just not a question in my mind, and yeah.
How would you propose funding these reserves? Where would they come from?
The majority of this is general fund. The vast majority of this, the fire rescue district for some of their items, we have a 50-50 split, but for maintenance, typically that is general funded.
General fund stuff. Gotcha.
I'll tell you, this budget cycle, any new construction, I'm going to be all over it.
That 2 to 4%, you know, putting away for, you know, for R&R, as you said, that's just common sense, you know. And I'm kind of surprised, you know. I mean, I don't know. I'm kind of surprised that we don't already have that set up. I mean, anyone that runs a business, you know, just imagine an Uber driver has to take a certain percentage of that income to be replacing that vehicle that is stop and go and putting miles on. So I'd be kind of surprised if we don't already have something like that.
I'm not surprised.
No. All requires taxpayer dollars to do it.
I think it was just a different philosophy. The funds are there. They just haven't been locked down and allocated directly to facilities. Kind of have the bucket in the background. But in this case, we'd be able to really identify what funding is going where.
It's a mad scramble every time we have a capital need. I mean, you can't run a business that way. You can't run a city that way. I have a question, if I may, Mayor. So I haven't gotten through this report, but I am going to read the whole thing. And I do have one question. So when the police move out of their current headquarters, what does that building look like? Because I certainly have been going to the community and saying, oh, wonderful news. We don't have to build a new building for the City Hall annex. We could refurbish that building. Where would that specifically fall in terms of this criterion? Don't tell me more than 30%.
That would be handled differently. So that's basically a reset of that building. That's not necessarily a facility condition assessment situation. That's more of a reset to meet the needs of the new occupants. So I know that there are a couple capital improvement projects that are included in the draft budget at this point for consideration to go forward, depending upon what owner group will end up utilizing that space.
Right. Okay, thank you for that.
Vice Mayor.
Yeah, since we're going into the budget process of this, between 2% and 4%, I fully understand we need to have a piggy bank in there to be able to cover these costs, but we also need to take into consideration on construction costs in the future, how they fluctuate up and down. So if we just went with the bare minimum, is that good enough? If we went halfway, is that good enough? Or do we need to go to that 4% to have all of our bases covered? And since it's coming from the general fund, this has to be like a unified sacrifice between all the departments involved, to where we got to come up with this number. So what are we giving up to get this number?
And let me start with your first comment. We're working with the consultant, and as part of this, they have a software that doesn't stay static. So it will continue to upgrade those numbers, not just the numbers for the value of our buildings, but also the costs associated with replacing things. It's a dynamic system that when we replace something, it will acknowledge that and recalculate the numbers. So we're working on that second phase coming up. But that will help us keep those numbers fresh, and it won't be a, 10 years from now, we're using the value of our buildings that I'm saying today to determine that 2 to 4%.
Right. No, and I understand that. But what I'm saying is when we're doing that math, something's got to give to get, let's say, $2 million. So where are we robbing from Peter to pay Paul for something that we need? Everybody needs to be on board saying, hey, I may not need X this year, so let's get that money over there. And that's totally up to the city manager and bringing the budget forward. And if the numbers all come out and they're good, I'm fine with that. We do need to have a savings account for this. And I just want to make sure it's proper and we're not underslighting ourselves as well, too. So you guys do great bringing all this information back. And I hate to have you bring information and we sort of change it on you, but It is a plus to where we can talk about this a little bit more. So I appreciate all your time and effort. That's all I had, Mayor.
Yeah. I would, just to piggyback, I see Commissioner DeValle's up there, but just to piggyback off of the Vice Mayor, that's, obviously that's going to be the challenge in this budget cycle. And, I'm all in on this. I mean, this is the right way to do this. We need to have the reserves to do this. We cannot kick the can down the road. We'll reach a point where these buildings will be beyond the ability to fix and maintain and have to be replaced. And we all know what nightmare that becomes. So I'm good with that. But at the same time, as the Vice Mayor says, the budget is so big. You got a big balloon, as our county administrator likes to say. You got so much air in that balloon. Squeeze one side, the other side opens. And vice versa. So you all have to decide what's getting cut to pay for this, because that's what's going to happen. Because there's only a finite amount of dollars that are available from the taxpayers.
Just Mr. DeValle. Mayor, that's Chief Titus that likes to play the balloon game when it comes to the budget. Just saying.
I did. Just this morning I was looking at, the extended, I think there's 123 sheets or 128.
You can borrow my printed.
The first point that struck me was on the facility condition assessments, it showed fire sprinklers is a medium and HVAC is a high. I would think just for safety that the fire should have been in the high category, but I'm sure you've looked at that. On page 14 of that, it talked about the roofs that were beyond their recommended life, and City Hall was one of those. And my question is, well, you could have a roof that's beyond its recommended lifespan, but if you did an inspection, you might find out that, hey, for various reasons, maybe it isn't ready to be replaced. So I'm just asking if, are we inspecting things like that? You know, like I know we did have a leak in the, you know, City Hall roof, and I don't know, you know, if the plan is to replace the whole roof or, you know, if we've just done the repairs. That's one observation I made. On page 15, it talked about desired levels and a renovation or repair level. And it said that the desired level is less than 20, and the renovation or replace level is greater than 50. It just made me think, well, what happens between 20 and 50? It's desired, or maybe it's not desired, but it's not at the repair or replace level yet. And then I looked at, I just saw some numbers, you know, like on page 31, it talked about City Hall needing greater than $7 million in 2025, with the replacement value being $22.7 million. Can we really build another City Hall for $22.7 million? If so, let's do it. you know, I'm just questioning some of the numbers there. You know, I mean, you know, realistically, $22.7 million to replace City Hall today, I just can't see that as being accurate.
And we have asked them to go back through some of these numbers, and they have adjusted those. The $26 million is probably closer to accurate, but it's still a lower number. That does not include any of the finishings or furnishings or any of that stuff. That's just the building. And if you mentioned City Hall roof, we are working on a grant for a replacement of the roof. But before we do any work, and we've been meeting with the departments as well, in addition to this report, there's individual reports per building. It's just a really, you know, huge document that we have. And they're looking to ground truth some of those things too. You know, if it just doesn't meet lifespan or it looks like it's aged, but they know they don't use it that much, we're working to reprioritize those things to make sure that the money and the effort that is being spent are on the highest priority items.
I would, you know, again, this conversation, and it'll be part of our budget conversation, is going to come down to it's hopefully this year that this commission finally addresses the mechanisms necessary to help finance our capital needs going forward. Going out to referendum and asking with your hand out for the money to do what has to be done to run a city this size is just not viable. And we need to have in place the mechanisms to do what has to be done in order to keep pace with the needs, the capital needs this city has. And one way or the other, we're going to have to bite this bullet and deal with it. And we'll know better after the 13th. But make no mistake, it's going on an agenda. If I have to ask for it myself, this is going to be the beginning of a long conversation about how we deal with our capital needs. Because every single department in this city is getting strangled by it. And we have no real solutions to it because we don't have the money for it. And unless we start using some of the more creative methodologies out there to do it, okay, we're going to be in trouble. And the costs just keep going up and up and up. So with that, I don't know if anybody's got anything else. Any public comment on this item? Happy to hear that. there's nothing more. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
And with that, unless anybody else has anything, it's 11:53 and I adjourn this workshop.